My name is Maitreya Bandhu, and I'm down to give a talk on enlightenment. The word talks is far too grandiose. Ramble might be better, or chat, sort of fireside disquisition. So when I told Rhea, who's my half-daughter, I told her that I was going to give a talk on enlightenment, she said, that sounds very boring. which I thought, you know, so it's worth getting that out. So Rhea is going to spend her time doing her top model drawing. I'll try not to be distracted by her top model drawing and talk about enlightenment, which I'll try not to make very boring. Yeah? So what I'll do is I'll talk for a while until I stop talking. See whether there's any questions and see whether I can answer any questions. I may or may not be able to. Yes, do make raspberry noises at appropriate. It's good to have that sort of counterpoint, I think. Okay, so it always feels terribly presumptuous to try and talk about enlightenment. Terribly presumptuous. The first thing I don't want to say about it is that... Oh, here we are. Somebody else coming in. Come in. Hi there. So perhaps just sit on the stage, in the chair. Oh, that's great. So, yes, when I think about talking about enlightenment, it feels terribly presumptuous. And rather grand, doesn't it? So it's quite good to have Sky here and Rhea here and just to make sure that we keep ourselves in the real world. So the first thing I always want to say about it is that I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't mean that in some sort of, you know, oh, isn't he charming kind of way. I mean it, you know, isn't he so humble? He started his talk saying he doesn't know, come in, doesn't know what he's talking about. There's a seat here at the front if you want to. Yeah, that's fine. So when I'm asked to talk about enlightenment, that's the first thing that always comes to mind is I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about, and you don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, come in. This is going to go on for a while. Keep coming. Keep coming. Don't be shy. I'll just let you settle down for a minute. There's a cushion here at the front, but nobody seems to want to take it. There's this huge kind of area of relaxed roominess here at the front. Yeah, that's fine. Sit down, that's fine. Hi there. Yeah, so I was just saying that when I think about enlightenment, the first thing I always emphasise is that I don't know what I'm talking about, and you don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah? And I really don't know, and you really don't know. Yeah. Enlightenment is a word that we use. It's actually a translation of a Buddhist word. Hi there, come in. Hi there, nice to see you again. The translation of the word is Nirvana, which isn't the pop group. Nirvana means literally snuffing out. The metaphor is that you snuff out a candle. Yeah. So that's not very helpful either. To say that you snuff out a candle. Sometimes people use the word awakening for enlightenment, but that's not very good either, because awakening suggests that you were just asleep and then you wake up. It's much, much more than that. Enlightenment at least suggests something full of light, yeah, a resounding of light, a illumination of light. So it's not a bad term, it's just that I don't know what it refers to. Yeah. It, for instance, doesn't refer to perfection. Perfection is a Western word, a Christian word. I've been thinking about perfection recently for various reasons, and perfection seems to be a word that doesn't refer to anything. It's a word that human beings have come up with because they know themselves to be so imperfect. And we imagine something that's absolutely other than that, something perfect. Yeah. Actually, there's no such thing. Yeah. It doesn't exist, perfection. So it's a fantasy word. It's a word that doesn't correspond to anything in reality. If you have a word like house, it's quite useful, isn't it? Because there's such a thing as a house. If you have a word like perfection, it makes you think that there's something in the world called perfect or perfection. But the word doesn't actually refer to anything. I was saying to somebody yesterday, it's a fully meaningless word, perfection. So enlightenment doesn't mean perfection either. I don't think it can be translated as perfection. That's a human fantasy, an understandable one, and it's getting at something, but it's not getting at something like the word house is getting at something, or wardrobe, or pram that Sky is just going to. So I don't know what I'm talking about, and you don't know what to talk about. So it's really important to get that clear before we get any further when we talk about enlightenment. I've got a sense of it, but I don't know what I'm talking about. So it's a bit odd to talk about something that you don't know what you're talking about. Now, if I was to say that, finish my talk there, that's a bit problematic. Don't know what I'm talking about. You don't know what I'm talking about. So it's tea break and there's cake, yeah? Now, if I literally didn't know what I was talking about, and you literally didn't know what we're talking about, then we would have no idea of moving towards it, would we? If we're talking about Birmingham, and I said, I've no idea where it is, and you've no idea where it is, there's no way that you can travel towards Birmingham, however far you are away. You know, if you were in, I don't know, Paris just now, or London just now, if we didn't, none of us knew anything of where Birmingham was, you'd have no idea where to get there, would you? So it's not true in that sense, yeah? That we don't, I literally completely don't know, and that you literally completely don't know. So you end up with something like, I don't know, which is true, and you'd want to caveat it by saying something like, and I sort of know. And I sort of know. Sort of being probably italicized. Sort of maybe. Sometimes I think I sort of know. Something very, very tentative like that. Or sometimes I think I sort of have a bit of a hint of it. Something like that, yeah? Something very, very tentative. Still rather problematic. So if I said to you today, I somehow sort of know a little bit, sometimes a bit about where Birmingham is, you might think, okay, so I really need someone with, you know, with better instructions that somehow think I sort of know where Birmingham is. But at least you could say it's sort of up north somewhere. At least that starts to orientate you in the right direction. Yeah. So we sort of know. So when you look at that figure of the Buddha, that's a figure of enlightenment. And you sort of have a sense of what it means, don't you? You don't know what it means. The danger, of course, is thinking that you do know what it means. And that's why I always want to start with saying, I don't and you don't know what that figure means. But it's not that you completely don't know what it means. You sort of, slightly get a sense of it, don't you? The gold, the posture, the radiance, the calm. You can read all those things from that image. It's not if you saw that image without knowing anything about Buddhism, you'd have a sort of sense of what the goal of Buddhism is, wouldn't you? Some kind of very vague, intuitive sense. Yeah? So that's where we are when we talk about enlightenment, any time we talk about enlightenment, and whoever talks about enlightenment, unless they themselves are enlightened. And my suggestion to you, ladies and gentlemen, is if someone says they're enlightened, I would leave the room. Yeah? Or, you know, I think, okay, I'm going to go and read a novel. As soon as someone makes any kind of claims about themselves, one always wants to say, let me be the judge of that. You know, if I say to you, I'm enlightened, which I'm not, you'd have to say, let me be the judge of that. I'll just see how you are over a long period of time. Yeah. So the only person who could really give a talk about enlightenment, what is enlightenment, would be someone who's enlightened, because they'd know what they were talking about. So what that ends up meaning is that the whole of the Buddhist tradition, what we call the Buddhist tradition, is somebody, the Buddha, trying to tell you about something, enlightenment, which you don't really understand. In fact, not just that you don't really understand, but you cannot understand with your ordinary consciousness. And that if you try to understand with your ordinary consciousness, you will get it wrong. So the Buddha himself was known to be metaphysically reticent, is a technical term, which means that he didn't tend to talk metaphysically. He didn't tend to talk about the nature of reality, the nature of enlightenment, what Buddhahood meant. His attitude would be, never mind all that. If I start to talk to you about all that, you'll just get it wrong because you won't be able to understand it. So where are you just now and what do you need to do to move towards enlightenment? So instead of saying, if you met the Buddha, if you use that metaphor of Birmingham, which I quite like, if you use that the Buddha wouldn't say, well, let me just really describe to you what Birmingham's like. That's not going to help you get there very much, is it? He'd probably say, tell you what, where are you just now? Okay, yeah, so probably what you need to do is walk down to the tube, yeah? Get a tube, and he'd have to explain that. That's what would be helpful, wouldn't it? He wouldn't say, well, in the centre of Birmingham, there's this square with a fountain, and that sometimes doesn't work. It seems every time I go there, it doesn't work, but that's another matter. He could describe that fountain in great detail and the beauty of the water, but that really wouldn't help you very much, would it? And you'd be going, okay, give me where, you know, what do I do? You know, it's all very, that sounds very nice, that fountain outside the art gallery in Birmingham, but what do I do? And he'd want, so he mainly was metaphysically reticent. He'd say, never mind me describing the city of Birmingham and the centre square and the and that lovely new fountain by Anish Kapoor, I think, you know, Rowan Mystery, something like that. He'd want to give you directions, yeah? So the main thing that the Buddha did is give directions to how you get to Birmingham, and then you can find out how remarkable Birmingham is, yeah? So do you see how it's useful to transpose it into ordinary language? Enlightenment sounds like a place that you could go. So, okay, well, let's say it's Birmingham. It's no great help discussing what Birmingham looks like. You need to know, first of all, how to get there, and then you can see what it looks like. I've recently come back from the south of France and I went to see Cézanne's studio. I've seen lots of photographs of Cézanne's studio, but when you go up that little stairs and step into the studio, it's a wholly different experience. None of the photographs really do it justice. You have to go there. Yeah? And that's exactly the same with enlightenment. You can say all kinds of things about it, but the main thing is to go there. Yeah? So that's the first two things I want to say. I don't know what I'm talking about. You don't know what I'm talking about. I kind of sort of slightly do know what I'm talking about, and you kind of sort of slightly do know what I'm talking about. But that makes the journey quite tricky, because it's not like I literally know where Birmingham is and so do you, and you can get there on the Virgin trains. We just at the moment have a bit of a sense of where Birmingham is. So what the Buddhist tradition becomes, what we call the Buddhist tradition, which sounds terribly grand, is somebody, the Buddha, trying to tell you about somewhere that you don't know and you don't know how to get there, or you have only a very vague idea how to get there. So he's basically trying to describe an experience to you that you've never had, which would be like me telling you about ice cream, but let's say you'd never ever tasted ice cream. I could say it's cold and sweet and all that, but you, unless, the trouble is, even that word ice cream, you sort of know what it is. If you think of what we've got is a word that we don't actually know what it refers to. Yeah. Recently, a while ago, I remember in a study group talking about this, and somebody, I said it's a bit like somebody trying to describe a guinea pig if you've never seen a guinea pig. And there was a German person in the room and said, "What's a guinea pig?" And I had this really weird moment that. What do you do if someone says, "What's a guinea pig?" You think, "It's a guinea pig." And say, "Yes, but I don't know. What does it?" You can, if you have, you have to remember, you can't Google it. So you have to say, "Well, it's a bit like a rabbit, but it's got hasn't got the big back legs, and it hasn't got." And you end up doing great damage to a rabbit, don't you? To come at something that looks is horribly mutilated guinea pig. You know what I mean? I sort of, and you could imagine them saying, "Oh, I kind of get it," and you'd think, wouldn't you? If I had to get you from a rabbit to a guinea pig because you'd never seen one, you'd leave the room thinking, "Yeah, I kind of get a guinea pig," but I'd be knowing, "I really kind of doubt it. I really kind of doubt it." But you see, that is actually literally the Buddhist tradition. The Buddha trying to tell you about something that you don't know anything about. So all he can do is say, "What do you know about? You know about rabbits." So, okay, I can. It's a bit like that, but without the great big ears, yeah? Do you want to just sit down there, Andy? Do you want to just sit down there? Yeah. It's a bit like a rabbit, but without the big ears, yeah? And that would be, you'd sort of leave thinking that's not a very good image, yeah? So anytime anyone talks to you about enlightenment, anytime what the Buddhist tradition is really that attempt to say, here's something I've experienced that you haven't experienced, and then to try to find something in your experience that you have experienced and say it's a bit like that. So he'd say something like, you know, you've had those moments of kindness, very rare, you have proper moments of full kindness. Well, it's a bit like that, not quite like that, but hugely bigger. So you think, okay, a bit of kindness, hugely bigger. And he'd be thinking, sort of. Like the thing I've been thinking about very much recently is love, the nature of love, what we mean by love. And I think we easily get that wrong. Anyway, I'll come back to that in a moment. So that's what we end up with the Buddhist tradition. The Buddha is trying to tell us something that we haven't experienced, and then he's having to say it's a bit like something you have experienced, but that's mutilating and distorting what it actually is. And what you'd end up with is only something very slightly like it. So you can see why, principally, he teaches a path. It's to say, well, actually, let's not even go there. How do you get to the bus stop? Let's start with that, yeah? And when you come to the Buddhist centre here, very often that's what we do. We just sort of say, okay, never mind that. Where are you now? How do you get to the bus stop? Yeah? And if you're drunk just now, the first thing you need to do is sober up. And if you're like perilously unhappy at the moment, well, you're going to need to work with that, et cetera, et cetera. Because first of all, I need to get you to the bus stop. Never mind it. Never mind Birmingham. So the traditional way, one traditional way, a simple way that enlightenment's talked about is in terms of the fullness of compassion, the fullness of wisdom, and the fullness of energy. So it's supposed to be all of those three things. Yeah, the fullness of compassion, the fullness of wisdom, the fullness of energy. I thought I'd just take two of those. Usually it's talked about just in terms of compassion and wisdom, which I think is slightly misleading, because then that sounds a bit too soft. It's also the completion of your energy, what your energy fully wants to do. I'd have to give another talk on energy, I think. And I haven't got that much time. So I wanted to talk a bit about love and wisdom, because that gets us a bit closer, doesn't it? I don't know where it would get to. I don't know what's on the way to Birmingham. It'd get us on the motorway, perhaps, if we start talking about compassion and wisdom. And I might try and finish talking. Yeah, that'll probably be enough. So the first thing, then, is the completion of compassion. So the figure you see in front of you, and again, it doesn't completely communicate that in a way, but the completeness, the full ripening of compassion. The word in Buddhism is bhavana, which means, it's usually translated as making to become, but I much prefer the metaphor of ripening. Yeah, that there is, in all of us, the seeds of, little hard apple of compassion, and that can ripen. And when something ripens, it grows, it reddens, it sweetens. You can pluck it off the tree. Yeah? So enlightenment is the ripening, the full ripeness of human compassion. The trouble is, you'll find me doing this quite a lot, the trouble is, when I say that, that sounds like it's a simple continuum. You can imagine yourself in a good mood, in a feeling kind mood, and you just imagine that being extended into a ripe good mood, where you're like in a good mood all the time. It's not like that. Yeah? Goes much, much beyond that. In fact, if you think of that, then you'll never get there, because you'll always know that you could be kinder. Yeah? And you say so you'll end up with what's called an infinite regress. It's not like that, but it'll do for now. So let's talk about then for a moment this ripening of compassion. I, at the moment, prefer the language of love. It's got problems because it easily suggests romantic love, and it's not that. But the word love is much more emotive than compassion, which sounds a bit sort of strangely technical, yeah, and even condescending. So the ripening of love is how I'm thinking of the Buddha. And I've been struck, I don't know whether anyone's read the novels of Marilynne Robinson. Has anyone read the novels of Marilynne Robinson? You should run out and buy them just now. Her first novel, Gilead, well, no, it was her second novel, but I first read Gilead, which won the Pulitzer Prize. She took 23 years to write it. Fantastic thing. Well, it's one, I think she is a modern, great writer, quite undoubtedly, I think. When you read her, you feel that step change experience from very good writing to a writing that, even if you tried really, 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 really hard, you couldn't do it. And I'm just reading her second novel, Home, which is the same story as Gilead, told from the perspective of somebody else, which creates an incredible moral, in the best sense, ambiguities and problems, which I found fascinating. But I was very struck that there's one scene, I don't think it spoils it, but there's one scene where the father, there's a father and a son in both novels, a very old father who's dying, and a son that's just left home for 20 years and comes back, and there's been hardly any contact with him for 20 years. And there's a climactic scene, I'm near the end of the book, and there's a climactic scene where the father, who's very, very ill and old, comes down into the kitchen very frailly, and his son's there, and his daughter's there. And he says to his son, all of these years, these 20 years, I've been praying to God not to love you so much. Yeah, all of these 20 years, I prayed and prayed. He's a minister, he's a Presbyterian minister. I've been praying to God that I didn't love you so much, because that would have made it easier. Yeah, that would have made your completely unknown absence. And he's always been in the novel, he's always been a kind of really problem child, and then became a problem adult. And his father, who's a minister, always tries to deal with the problem of his son. He's got four sons and four daughters, I think. And there's this one problem child that the whole family is preoccupied with. And he says, I pray to God that I wouldn't love you so much. I was really struck by that. Pray to God I wouldn't love you so much. And he said, and I've made no progress in those prayers. Yeah, I've made no progress in those prayers. And it's heartbreaking in the book, because what he means is, if I didn't care so much, it would have been easier to bear this. You didn't come home for your mother's funeral. Da, da, da. I could have borne it if it didn't bother me so much. I could have managed, I could have borne it. And you feel in the book that the father's kind of broken by this. Yeah. Really, I was really, really struck by the honesty of that writing. And it made me reflect on the nature of love, which is that love wants to fully express itself, even if that creates terrible pain for you. You know, if anyone has children in their life, you can't not love them. What happens to them is going to touch you in every place, whatever happens. You never know what happens. Yeah? But love, our instinct for love, which wants to ripen itself, so that love is for everyone all the time. Now, that sounds a bit grandiose, but what I've been noticing, it's had a slightly difficult year this year. Been all sorts of turbulences within the order that I'm a part of. Some, I'm afraid, fallings out. And I found that very painful. And just the other day, a friend of mine was saying, problem with you, Matrawandu, is you care too much. Why don't... And it really struck me that it's an echo of this old Boughton, this preacher, praying to God that he didn't love his son so much. As soon as you make any kind of contact with people, they kind of stay in your life somehow. And if you turn away from that, turn against that, if you cut that off in your own heart, you cut off something in yourself. So love is a terrible burden. People eulogize love, but at the moment I'm experiencing in some ways a kind of terrible burden. And what's been striking me, when I say if you've made contact with anyone in your life, when you had even a moment of meeting them, I remember an old friend of mine who had a terrible temper, and I was frankly really quite terrified of him. But I remember once talking to him and looking at him in the eye, and for a moment I completely seemed to understand him and therefore love him. Yeah, which I didn't, because, you know, I also know that he had a terrible temper. And it was in Bush better, I said, tell you what, I don't care. Yeah, and I could say that, but I don't ever really mean it. Sort of meaning on one level and underneath, that love won't go away. So one of the things I've been thinking about that is that when we talk about like that, coming into contact with someone, we still have this idea that our mind is a thing. So if I think my mind is a thing that's locked inside my brain or in my body, then, you know, your mind is a thing locked inside your brain. And so we come into contact with each other sometimes, but then you go off and I don't need to worry about you, as it were, and you don't need to worry about me. But the mind isn't a thing. As soon as you realise the mind isn't a thing, all kinds of eventualities are possible. But what that means, if the mind isn't a thing, is when I meet that friend of mine, who's got this, used to have at least, this terrible temper, that love is there immediately, because I've mixed with them in my mind. My mind has been their mind for a moment, and because my mind isn't a thing. Recently I had somebody that I've had found very painful, and I met them suddenly, and I felt immediately that love, and then immediately, oops, I need to be careful. That's, you know, have you ever felt that when you think, oh, I need to be careful, yeah? I'm not very good at being careful, as you can tell. But you see how I feel, I need to think about this more, I need a whole room full of people to think about anything. I think that, do you see how that love wants its own way, which is to love all people all the time, without backing off, without injury. So from that point of view, you have to imagine that that figure is like that. Yeah. It's still not quite right, but it'll give you, it gives you, we're onto the motorway towards Birmingham, if you think that. Yeah. So that anything that takes you to that is taking you to Birmingham. Yeah. Even if that's just you being a bit more patient with someone, that's moving you a little bit towards a bus stop, which moves you a little bit towards a tube, which moves you a little bit more to getting to Euston, which moves you a little bit more to getting on that train to Birmingham. Yeah. Every moment that I'm more patient, more kind, and so on, I move towards getting on a bus. The trouble is, you get on the bus, and then you get off it again at the wrong stop. Or sometimes you get on a bus and you get on another bus, go all the way back. You know what I mean? It's as simple as that, yeah? And that's what human growth is always like. You never get on a bus, get straight to the tube station. Bet you what, you get on the bus, you get annoyed at somebody talking on their mobile, you're all the way back to the start again. Do not go past go. So that's one way of talking about the ripening of love. So if you think about the ripening of love, I haven't actually thought about this before, but there we go, it seems to be going all right. Think about the ripening of love. What that means is you're saying yes, always. Always saying yes, 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 yes. And in Marilyn Robinson's book, The Father, one of his verbal tics is to keep saying yes, yes, yes. So the ripening of love is always saying yes. Always saying yes to all of your experience, and never saying no. Especially by saying yes to anything good, to patience, to love, to generosity, especially generosity. And then you get to this ripening of wisdom. I mean, I can't even touch on the ripening of energy. But then if you think of the ripening of wisdom, wisdom effectively is the reverse of love. So love is that, yes. And then there's, as I said, you know, sometimes when you've had a difficulty with someone, there's that yes, and then there's that no, isn't there? Or there's that yes, and then there's that maybe. The wisdom element coming in, which is to do with judgment, understanding, clarity. Because if there was just yes, you'd be a fool, wouldn't you? You'd be a fool. And there's no progress in being a fool. There'd just be a kind of, I don't know, benign foolishness. sometimes you get something of that in people. It's rather lovely, but it's not enough. Yeah? You need wisdom. The problem with the word wisdom is it sounds very cognitive, doesn't it? It always sounds rather intellectual. Actually, what wisdom is kind of the ripening of intelligence. Now, intelligence is quite a different thing from intellect. I think it's a shame that we haven't got enough words in English. I meet intellectual people who are intelligent. I meet intellectual people who are very stupid. I meet people who are not at all intellectual, including people who can't write, read or write, who are very intelligent. Yeah. I have a friend of mine, for instance, who has a kind of sporting intelligence. He's not a great reader, he's not a great thinker in a certain sort of way, but he has a sportsman's instinct for the weight of the ball in his hand. And that instinct is transferred to his perceptions of people, his perceptions of the Buddha, the perceptions of the Dhamma. He weights them in his hand like a cricket ball. I know another friend of mine who's very emotionally intelligent. His instincts is very clear about people. So intelligence is nothing to do with being intellectual. Very often, being intellectual is positively stupid. I think probably the clearest way of putting it is that I like to use better to use the word clever. I know some very intellectual people who are quite wonderful, and their intellect is a kind of beauty. I've met this again and again, and if you ever meet somebody who has a proper intellect, next Saturday evening, do come along. I'm going to be interviewing Hermione Lee, who wrote the biography of Virginia Woolf and wrote a wonderful biography of Penelope Fitzgerald and various other people. Hermione Lee, she's wonderful, right? And I've been reading her just recently. She's properly intellectual. And when you read her, it's like really enjoyable. You feel your mind lightening up and waking up and becoming interested. Genuine intellectual is fascinating, yeah? What you don't want is clever, yeah? Cleverness is a particular breed of stupidity. It often goes along with cynicism and so on. Yeah, I tend to think of clever as a pejorative word. So if you call me clever, I'll be offended. Rhea's taking note. So wisdom is a kind of is a ripening of intelligence. And golly, we need as much intelligence in this much more... I prefer it if we think of it as a kind of sporting thing. Real intelligence is embodied. It's a kind of physical thing. It's a bit like how a sportsman holds a bat. It's how they understand the weighting of the bat and so on. It's a physical instinct. And it can be translated into words, but real intelligence is a translation of intuition. I tend to be rather pushed over onto the intuitive side and struggle to translate it into words. You wouldn't believe it, would you? You wouldn't, would you? So if you think of it like that, and how I've been thinking about it, I don't know whether this is right or not, but I'm thinking more and more of wisdom as saying no. Just as compassion is saying yes, wisdom is saying nope, nope, nope. No. And I was thinking that, and then I remembered that you have a perfection of wisdom, don't like that word perfection, but let's gloss that for a moment. In other words, the let's call it the ripening of wisdom, all these sutras which are called the ripening of wisdom, you have them in 100,000 lines, in 100 lines, you have them all, you know, you had times where they wrote books and books about it, and it can come all the way to one syllable, the perfection or the ripening of wisdom in one syllable. And that one syllable is ath, which in Buddhism, in Sanskrit, is a negative precept, prefix, ahimsa, non-violence. That's what ahimsa means, non-something. It means no. Yeah. So wisdom is saying no, 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 no. And golly, we really need that, don't we? So just today, yesterday and today, I was reading about... the terrorist attack in Barcelona. The whole problem of tourism in Barcelona. There's 32,000 I don't know, a huge amount of tourists that come in a really quite small city. It's really problematic. But then you get this terrible attack of people, this new thing of driving vans, you know. And when you read it, you have a really strong no, don't you? No. And you should have. I don't want anything to do with that. I don't want anything to do with that. I don't want anything to do with that instinct to hurt. Yeah? The trouble is, all of us are implied. We all have an instinct to hurt, and in certain conditions would hurt people. One should never do oneself the favour of thinking that you wouldn't do it. Like, you know, I don't know, sometimes talk about the Nazis or something. If you were in a particular age range with a particular income, you're most likely to have been one. You would not most likely to be the person who is really lovely and, you know, hides a Jewish family in your basement or something. You're very unlikely to be that person. I'm unlikely to be that person. We kid ourselves into thinking that we would always be the good one. It's terribly, terribly difficult. Again, it's the burden of love. You imagine those people hiding someone at complete danger to their own lives and their family's life. It's a terrible burden. Somewhere they must have thought, I can't say no. I can't say no to that, yeah? But all of us somewhere want to say no to hatred, no to violence, no to harm. But golly, there's a lot to learn. But this no saying of wisdom is a no saying to the world. And it's a complete no saying. It's saying no, no, no. So for me, for instance, when I was a child, I come from a small town in Warwickshire. I remember having that really, really early, really young. I wanted to say no. No one in my family could understand. I come from a large family, got three older brothers and a younger sister. And they didn't seem to want to. It seemed to be fine from them, the town that we lived in. I wanted to say no to everything. I thought it was rubbish. I mean, actually, that's not fair. It was, when I say it, what I meant the world, including me. But it's not fair. But that's how I felt. I thought people weren't telling the truth. I couldn't see the point of anything. I remember feeling, what is the point of going to school, doing all that work which I don't want to do, then getting a job which I probably won't like, then getting married, having a family, going, you know, getting pension, then dying. What is the point? Yeah. And some people feel that very strongly. I felt it very strongly. Very, very difficult to keep living up to, because as you get older, it's very, very easy to get complacent and to forget that no. But I felt it, and I still feel it very strongly, that no, no, no. It's not enough. It's not good enough. It's not right. It's not it. Yeah. Sometimes that no is so strong, but other people can't understand what it is. You're, why not? You know, and you just feel like saying, "It's just not it. It's not it. It's not right. It's not it." You don't mean. I remember thinking, "That can't be it, can it?" I remember I was very young, about a bit younger than Rhea, about six, I think, or seven. My grandmother died. She was a great grandmother. She was 93 when she died. I remember I used to go around to, I spent all my time with her when I was little. I used to run around from my house and just be with my grandmother all day. She used to always wear black because her husband had died, but he'd died like 40 years before, you know. But she always wore black after that. She had these two huge Alsatians. So you have to remember this, think of this little frail old woman who was terribly powerful, with two huge Alsatians wearing black, like Victorian black. I loved my grandmother. She liked me as well, and that helped. Anyway, I remember she died, and unusually, and I still don't kind of understand it, but my parents, my dad and my mother, took myself and my brother to go and see her in her coffin on the bed. The coffin was on the bed, and she was in coffin. Very impressive thing to do. I'm really glad that they did that. We cover up death as if there's something shameful about it, as if it isn't part of life. And I remember going, and I remember it very clearly. I remember the coldness of the room, and that strangeness of going to my grandmother's bedroom. I never had been to my grandmother's bedroom. She was always in the lounge with the Aga and these two huge, rather smelly, hairy dogs. it's really odd going into her bedroom. And I remember either my father or my mother saying, oh, she's asleep. And I think somebody, my father or mother, said she's gone to a better place. And I remember thinking, nope. You know, as children aren't fools, you know, I remember thinking, nope. I've seen my grandmother asleep and she doesn't look anything like that. You know, I know what sleep looks like. I mean, it's only tiny, but you know what sleep looks like. Definitely not asleep. I knew it wasn't that. And gone to a better place? Nope, I have no idea. But that becomes, doesn't it, the great problem in life, that it ends with death. I seem to, in that moment, it's the beginning of wisdom. In that moment, life had this massive problem right at the centre of it. I couldn't have articulated that problem. I couldn't have explained it. But there, right at the centre of life, was this humongous problem of death. And it was the one thing that you knew would happen, and the one thing that you didn't know when it would happen. Now, I couldn't have articulated that to myself, but I remember really clearly thinking, oh no, crumbs, you know, this is a massive fact. And I also instinctively knew that my parents didn't know what it was, that nobody knew. I thought, they don't know, and what people say about it, that nobody knows. And that's still true. Nobody knows what happens when you die. One of the last times I've been in this room, we had a funeral. An old friend of mine who I've known for 30 years or so, you know, died you know, relatively young, in his early 60s. No idea what it means. But there it is. There's that problem. Problem with the biggest capital P you could ever want. The one thing you absolutely don't want to happen to you will happen to you, and you've no idea when. And it's when we start to respond to that problem emotionally, intellectually as well, but not in that pejorative way, not cleverly, because good heavens, there's nothing to be clever about when there's death. Do you see what I mean? When you think of death, nothing in the world, nothing at all to be clever about. Something to think about, good heavens, yes. Something to reflect about, something to turn over again and again and try and work it out, but nothing to be clever about there. Not in the slightest thing. Nothing to be ironic about. Nothing to be a bit distanced about. But I think when you start to touch that, in the very moment that you start to touch that, this figure arises. Because this figure is the solution to that problem. So when we talk about enlightenment, whatever that is, it's the solution, capital O, S, capital O, possibly capital O, it's the solution to that great problem. It's the solution. Usually what we do is we come up with half solutions that aren't really solutions at all. I'll get a good job, I'll get a good partner, I'll get a good career, I'll get more money, I'll be more successful, I'll become a star, I'll become a celebrity, I'll become a top model. They're mock solutions, they're pretend solutions, they're not solutions at all. But if we at all start to turn towards the facts of life, immediately in that moment is the possibility of a solution. If there was no solution, there'd be no question. So the solution I'm saying today, and I'll finish with this and then we'll have a bit of time for questions, the solution is somehow, to use these metaphors, is to ripen love. And love is a burden. It wants to express itself completely, irrespective of whether that's in your own interest or not. People have done incredible things for love. People have died for it. They've saved other people because of the burden of love. It's happened again and again, hasn't it? You forget yourself, and out of love, you're the one who jumps in and helps them. Or you're the one who goes back into the burning building. It's happened again and again. So it tells you that human beings can perfect love. Yeah? Perfect, terrible word. Ripen love. But then you also need, which I'm saying is a yes saying. It's a saying yes. Even when you really want to say no, when you feel hurt, when you're... your partner tells you, actually, I've gone off with somebody else, or your beloved parent dies, or you feel aggrieved, or unfairly criticised, even unfairly criticised on Facebook and all that sort of thing. The current way of criticising somebody is never to talk to them, it's just to publish it on some kind of internet forum. You know, even all of that, you still somehow are learning to say yes. But you're also trying to say no. No. No to Facebook, no to the internet, no to gossip mongering, no to slander, no to misrepresentation, no to unclarity, no to smallness and meanness and narrowness and stupidness and unthinkingness and prejudice and the whole world you're saying no to. And you see that those two things don't go together. You can't say yes all the time and no all the time. If you did that, you see that another consciousness needs to arise where saying yes and saying no can completely lie on top of each other and become a new kind of consciousness. That new kind of consciousness is the consciousness of a Buddha. That new kind of consciousness, whatever there is, where no and yes can be completely unified, is enlightenment. Okay, so that's as much as I want to say about that just now. So we've got a few minutes. Hopefully that's all completely clear. You don't need me to. But if there's any questions, we've got a few minutes, we can take questions, yeah.
So I understand a bit clearer the relationship between a no and a yes. So when you say, when you were saying about, you know, it's important to say no to things, well, I, as well as saying no to practical things like Facebook, I also think that you were also trying to say when you were counseling when you were younger, saying, almost saying no to the here and now, like, this isn't enough, and therefore you that's why you go towards enlightenment, because, yeah. You know, no to kind of conventional solutions, no to closed solutions, and, yeah. But then at another point, I think you were decrying some sort of like over-intellectualism or kind of, in particular, cynicism and scepticism.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would be interesting to understand your views on what's the relationship between that and the no's as well.
Because yeah, that's a really good question.
In particular, when yeah. You were talking about, you know, where, the story of your grandmother's yeah. death and you were saying no, I kind of felt the no you were saying then was no. Someone said, oh, she's gone somewhere better, and you were saying no. I kind of felt like that no was more cynicism and scepticism. And
right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, is cynicism and scepticism and rationality maybe sometimes kind of amenable to the Buddhist way, or I don't know how.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd make a real distinction between cynicism and scepticism. Scepticism is very important, genuine scepticism. It's quite rare. The poet Robert Frost is a great skeptic. He won't say. I mean, he's a fantastic, clever, his poet, and clever, I don't want to use that word, but do read him, because it looks like he's saying yes, and then you think, actually, you think he might be saying no. He won't say. He won't say yes to God, and he won't actually say no. He's very, very interesting with Frost in that way. So genuine scepticism, where you really are keep thinking and won't go to a false solution, I think is wonderful. Actually, very rare, genuine scepticism. Cynicism is a mock saying no. You know, when you're young, you say, oh, what's the point? You don't ever mean to answer that question, do you? When you say, oh, what's the point? Actually, you're just doing a kind of metaphysical moaning. No, you don't think, yes, let's think about that. That's a really good question. What is the point? Well, it seems to be the ripening of love. You know. So when I think of cynicism as a sort of false no, a mock no. And it's often a kind of cleverness, isn't it? I'm not touched by that sort of thing. So I always want to make that distinction between scepticism and cynicism. Cynicism, you can't do anything with it. It needs to wring its neck. It's of no use to anyone. And the trouble is it gets enculturated and even rather trendy and makes you look rather cool, you know, that you're distanced. I really dislike that instinct of distancing, especially with the fact of death. You think it's just ridiculous. You know, on your grave, will you say, I managed to keep my cynical distancing? You think, well, how silly is that, you know? But yeah, I am saying no to the moment, in a way, yeah. I think the Buddha would say no to life as we know it with ordinary consciousness, in other words. When we talk about the moment, sometimes people think that Buddhism is about being in the moment. There's no such Buddhist teaching. actually, we're often trapped in the present moment, aren't we? You know, like if you feel low, you're trapped in that moment and you think, I'll never get anywhere, life is, you know, you'll do that, what's the point? It's just because you're trapped in the present moment. Actually, often we're trapped in the present moment. It's not a good thing at all. It's we make illegitimate overgeneralizations from feeling in a bad mood just now, yeah? But it's saying no to the world as we usually experience it with ordinary consciousness, that it's not enough, in other words. It's not. Do you have that experience where you feel like you can never bite life to its core? Like I was just came back from France and I've been looking forward to going to Suzanne's studio literally for 30 years. I've been meaning to go for all this time. I finally, you know, organised it. It's actually not that difficult. I didn't do it for. But, you know, and there I was in the south of France. There I was seeing Suzanne's motifs. But I can never bite life to its core. I can never quite get to the core of it. It's that you're saying no to. You want to get to the core of it, and you can never do that with ordinary consciousness. But I think it's a radical, world-destroying no that the Buddha's saying. We want to soften that because it's not very on-stream, it's not very likeable, but he's saying actually no. Yeah. But he's not, so he'd be a great sceptic, the greatest possible sceptic, but not the slightest bit cynical. Yeah. Very good question. It's quite difficult to tell when you're saying no, whether you're doing it from a bad mood. And you can see why. I mean, another way of putting it is that you leave the world with wisdom, saying no, and you come back to the world with love, saying yes. And what Buddhism's trying to do is get you to do both at the same time, which is, hang on, I can't go to Birmingham and come back from it at the same time. So what that's telling you, there's a conundrum which can only be solved at a higher level. Yeah. So you're always trying to leave the world with wisdom and come back to the world with compassion. You've done that even in your tiny way just now coming to this talk. You know, you could be at a film, you could be drunk in the pub just two doors down the road. You know, there's lots of other things you could be doing now. But in a tiny way, you've said no to the world just now. So you've left the world with wisdom, you've made a wise choice. And then hopefully you'll go back to the world a bit more, wanting to give to the world. Do you see what I mean? When you go on retreat, which is one of the things we always recommend that people do, you're leaving the world with wisdom and coming, and hopefully then so you can come back with compassion. That's what we always need to do, whether you're a Buddhist or not. Actually, that is a great test for all of us, I think. Look, perhaps we better finish there. It's 5 to 3. And you've all been sitting down for a long time. And Ria's nearly finished her top model drawing. So let's leave it at that. Okay. Thanks very much.